Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Welcome and thank you for joining us. You're listening to the Beyond 50 radio program. I'm Daniel Davis. On the program today, we're going to be celebrating Mother's Day, but we're also going to be taking a walk on the wild side as one person found ways to transform herself in situations she probably could have never even imagined. On the program today, we're going to be joined with someone who, losing her husband at the age of 57, decided to sign up for a 2,500-mile road trip down America's Pacific Northwest coast with a group of experienced motorcycle riders. Yes, motorcycle madness is upon us. What an interesting thing this was to see such a transformation. Joining us here on the Beyond 50 radio program today is our guest, the motorcycle maven, Linda Krill. Linda, thank you for joining us here today.
Glad to be with you, Daniel.
Now, you were kind of leading a pretty regular life. I mean, very well achieved all the things that you were doing here, and then something like this happens, and it sounds to me like maybe there was a particular wake-up call that had you do something different. What was going on there?
Well, I was a corporate executive and worked with Fortune 100 companies, and so I was a bicyclist, and I bicycled 100 miles a week, but I didn't motorcycle. And after losing my husband to cancer, I did all the things a widow is supposed to do. I followed all the advice, and I was exercising, and I was sleeping, and I was making sure to eat a balanced diet, and I was out trying basically some new things each day, and life wouldn't come back together for me, and I was very frustrated, because when you follow expert advice and it fails, what do you do next?
Exactly. It seems like you kind of go along, you're doing some things that probably are a little bit different from the group that you identify with, of course, as a corporate executive in a top 100 Fortune company, but, you know, at the same time, you probably found with the advent, I guess, of losing your husband, you know, asking some different questions.
I think we all ask those harder questions. What's life really about? And for me, I was my job with companies was helping them manage change. And so I tried all the things I tried with companies, and it wasn't working. And so 18 months later, after his death, when I was still very miserable, I said to myself, Einstein said, doing more of the same and expecting different results is insanity. And I said, that's what you would be saying to your customers if they were saying, I can't get my business to come back together. I would say, you've got to try something different. And so that was sort of my wake-up call.
Nothing like those, as they say, I think it was Florence Scovel's Shin in the Game of Life and How to Play It. Watch your words because they boomerang back with the results, don't they?
Exactly, Daniel. And so I idly one day was so frustrated, I thought, what's the most opposite thing I can think of for a widow to do? Mm-hmm. And I just made an idle threat just to be, you know, just to rebel for a moment and quit being the woman that was taking care of everybody else and being everybody else's role model. And I just said out there to the universe, if this doesn't work, I might as well learn to ride a motorcycle. And I was being sarcastic. I would have bet my whole retirement fund that I would never go out and do that.
Mm-hmm. And you know what's fascinating about this, too, just as you said that, is the fact that you said that, and you were joking, but
yes,
the fact is the subconscious mind does not understand that. It just knows what you say and says, okay, let's go about achieving this.
That's exactly right. I said the universe doesn't understand sarcasm. And so the next day, one day later, I was having lunch with a corporate executive friend that I've known for 30 years. And we were dressed up in our business clothes at a fancy restaurant. And he looks at me and says, Linda, tell me the truth. Tell me how it's really going. And I said, I'm miserable. And he was shocked because I usually could make things happen. And I said, I even threatened to learn to ride a motorcycle. And he starts to laugh. And he says, Linda, don't you know that once a year I organize motorcycle trips all over the world, and in 2 months, we're flying to Vancouver, Canada, renting Harleys, and we're going to go to Victoria Island and do the coast of Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. And he said those magic words, Redwoods, the Oregon coast, Crater Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him and I said, no, that's not me. I can't do this to my kids, you know, after all. And my mother is still alive at age 90, and she's already lost a son. I can't do something so reckless that will hurt them. And so I said, no. But what happened after that was I waited 30 days before the trip, and I finally said, it's time to do something different. And I signed myself up for a Harley Learn to Ride course, and I went and took a course, and I even failed it. And I even failed the DMV's test 3 more times before I finally passed. But a month later, with only 30 days of riding experience, I was flying out to join a group of experienced riders for this trip.
Now, what did you find that was different for you in riding a motorcycle?
Well, riding a motorcycle, you can see 360 degrees around you. And so, like, when you're going from the bridge that goes from Washington State to Oregon, it's 4 miles long, and it goes up in the air so far, and you're looking, and it's a grate. And so you can see everything above you and everything below you, and you feel the wind coming at you, and you can taste the salt of the ocean. And so when you ride on a motorcycle, you're totally, totally exposed, I should say, to the world. And it's also, you always know the element of danger, and you're on 2 wheels, not 4. So keeping yourself balanced on that bridge with the crosswinds coming across it, and people don't realize, but it was metal grate, and your tires will rotate, will bump back and forth when it goes on top of a graded bridge. So you're fighting with who gets to control this motorcycle. So there were many, many, many times I was scared to death.
About that time, you're starting to understand what it means from the song Judas Priest, Hellbent for Leather, I bet.
Yes. But the other thing that happened on this trip, several things happened for me, and this is exactly, we always tell people to pamper themselves. I needed to go out, you know, when anything traumatic happens, whether you lose a job, whether your health changes, you know, whether somebody you love gets sick, you know, when there's so many things that happen, all of us have experienced significant losses. And I often say by the time you're 40, people have experienced at least 20 of these. And by the time we're 50 and older, most people want a couple sheets of paper. And the thing is people tell us to pamper ourselves, but we also lose faith in ourselves and in the world when something dramatic happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this lower esteem, we're trying to go out and rebuild ourselves. And for me, this trip, what this did is showed me, hey, failure is a part of anything new you do. And as I said, I failed the test. And being afraid is a part of anything you do. But I can't begin to tell you how great you feel when you do something you're afraid of and you succeed. And it doesn't have to be a motorcycle. You know, if you just say, I've never been able to go to a singles event when you're suddenly widowed or single again, divorced or whatever, and you walk into that singles event that first night and you can walk out, you go, I did something. I finally did something for me. So I think we all have fears. And when we can go forward and say, you know, there's a group here in Washington that are over 50 that are learning to ride the bicycle for the first time in their life. And you can imagine those people, when they finally learn to ride a bike, appreciate it far more. And their self-esteem just explodes.
I remember in the first couple of years when we began the Beyond 50 radio program, we had a woman who's actually lives in Portland, Oregon, and she had actually set records for driving. And what she has is an old classic roadster.
Oh, my goodness.
And fascinating woman. And she said what she had started when she had started this journey was just after 9/11. And it was at that moment that 9/11 had happened that she began to question the idea of fear. And
right.
The whole thing was asking the simple question, don't you ever just get bored being afraid? You know, and that was the ambitious statement that she had made to herself. And it was from that point that she bought and jumped into this roadster. Wonderful looking car, too. You know, we're talking, you know, just the flat windshield, just as it is, one of the most uncomfortable looking cars for a long-term trip that, you know, she's been back and forth across the United States, you name it, and she's done this. And, you know, decided just to take this long road trip, and she's been through every city in the United States, you know, the main cities as far as that goes, you know, doing this coast-to-coast thing. And she says one of the biggest things she loves to talk to people about is, to me, what I believe is probably the number one killer among humans, and that is fear.
Yeah.
A lot of us die, really, I think. Is it from the diseases? That's an easy thing to point to. I think those things are a lot of times an onset from the fears that we harbor that we've never faced to realize these are truly illusions. And it sounds to me like you were just like her. You discovered that.
Well, that's why I named the book Blind Curves. Mm-hmm. There are times when staying in the present on the road is more painful than saying what else could be new. And when you go into a blind curve, you don't know what you're going to find. You could find a pickup truck hijacked in the middle of that curve. You could find a deer standing out in the middle of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when you go into a blind curve, you need to retreat. But other times when you get around that curve, you say, okay, this isn't any better yet. But if you take enough blind curves, eventually the horizon that you have to recreate from is that much bigger. And I think that's what's really important is when we do things that we say, this isn't me, and I'm not talking about illegal things, but I'm saying things that are out there that we don't do. Let me give you another example. On the trip, I'm wearing motorcycle leathers, and I'm standing next to this big motorcycle when we come to stops and get gasoline or stop to get food. And, of course, when you're wearing leathers and next to a motorcycle, all sorts of people come over and talk to you. And one of the things I realized is men that came over to talk to me were often wearing leathers, and they were fairly, for me, as business exec, were fairly scary looking. But when they would come over, we would just talk about ordinary things, and kids that were tattooed and had all sorts of metal on them would come over and talk to me normally. And I realized, oh my gosh, without realizing it, I had already eliminated so many people from my horizon of people I talk to and relate to. And we had time on the motorcycle trip to stop and talk at the gas station people and whoever was making our sandwiches at the Subway shops when we stopped. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, you know, we think we live in this country where we know everything about it because we can see it on TV and hear about it on the radio and on the Internet. But I realized how small I had let my world get. And since that motorcycle trip, I've just expanded so much. You know, if a guy comes to repair something here in my kitchen, I take time just to talk to him about him. And everybody has a story.
And you know what, Linda? You've discovered my secret. And that is exactly why I love doing what I do.
Yes, the story piece. We all have a story. And if you make that your mission to, as you meet someone, when you're checking out the grocery store and have nothing better to do, take a second and talk to the clerk.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing what you'll learn about them and about the world around you. And I don't mean that this has to be a thing to do, but if your world feels like it's getting smaller, and for a lot of us, when we get over 50 and we're not going to the same place of work every day and we're not doing a lot of the activities we did when we were younger, our world can get awfully small. And the thing is if you start to say to yourself, everybody is a source of connection, it's amazing the kinds of things you feel. So to me, that's even a blind curve, is to say, who is it that I'm not talking to? Who is it I'm not reaching out to? And it's not out in judgment that you listen to the stories. You look for what is interesting about them.
I agree with you 100%. I know that was it was funny. It was seems like within the last month I came across, it was both in the Yahoo, I guess, the news that they have on there from time to time. It'll pique my interest, a little headline about something there. But then I had also seen the same thing somewhere else within the same week, and it was how to become a fascinating person, interestingly enough. And I can't remember off the top of my head who the celebrity was. Very well-known guy, but one that you know is he's one of those celebrities you just know people love and they respect it. Okay. And he was giving, I think it was 4 pieces of advice on how you can be an interesting, fascinating, well-liked person. And the first thing, and I totally agree with this, is that when you first meet someone, be sure that you ask at least up to 5 questions first about the other person before you say anything about yourself.
Well, we live
in a world where a lot of times we want to shoot our mouths off about who we are before we even let somebody else even get a word in edgewise about what they're all about.
Well, and I think that's what life is all about, is learning how to expand who we are and learning new behaviors. And that's certainly a part of any new venture. And I think we have to keep reinventing ourselves daily. But I took the biggest blind curve for me, although everybody's proud of this motorcycle trip, and my daughter, when she was in college, all of her friends wanted to come home and meet me. And usually your college kids are trying to get away from their parents, not bring people home. But, you know, it's this whole idea that we have to keep moving forward and keep trying new things. And so when I started to write this book, I had already said that I would never write a book. And I took 6 years learning how to write because I wanted to write a story, not a preachy book that says, here's what you have to do. I just wrote a story about my experience. And I wanted it to be a read that when someone's reading this, said, oh my God, I'm enjoying this story so much. And so although I know it's the perfect story for baby boomers, because we're all asking, What Now? And that's the subtitle. It's One Woman's Unusual Journey to Reinvent Herself and Answer What Now. Is that question, what now, we can't necessarily look to our parents and can't look to people 10 years ago to answer the questions we're asking right now about our lives. The rules keep changing.
Boy, they certainly do that, don't they?
And I think the idea of what now, when sometimes the advice isn't out there, you know, and or the advice is old and old-fashioned, or the advice isn't something that relates to who we are. You know, I threw away the rules and went out and did something on my own. I think people have to be willing to do the same. And so this whole idea of blind curve living, I think, is just a part of our future. It's not something to be avoided. It's, hey, there are going to be blind curves, and we should just learn that, hey, when we try them, and if something doesn't work right, that's good news, because now we know not to go in that direction, go in a different direction.
How do you think your children seen you after you had done this trip, or perhaps even what types of, I guess, ideas did they have about you, let's say, while you were doing this that they may have shared with you that surprised you?
Well, all three daughters were excited. I mean, everybody worries about safety, and you have to. And I took the motorcycle safety classes, and I think that's very important, that you just don't buy a motorcycle and head out on a trip. I went and learned from the local police what caused accidents on motorcycles. And you, when you ride a motorcycle, you stay conscious every single moment. You're constantly watching your mirrors. You know, when you stop behind another car at a stoplight, you're watching in your mirrors for the car behind you to make sure they come to a stop that's safe away from you and that they don't miss you. And you're constantly thinking, where will I go if someone doesn't see me? And you're constantly working. But my three daughters were excited about me and actually bragged to their friends, look what my mother is doing. And I know that they all knew that I was very sad and that life wasn't coming back for me, together for me. So in a sense, when I said, I'm going to do something different, here's what I'm going to do, they turned out to be very encouraging. And my mother, who is 90 years old, she's been handing this book out to all of her friends at the retirement home that she lives in. And I thought 90-year-olds went, you know, and 80-year-olds went to enjoy this book. And they said, Linda, you wrote it in such a beautiful voice. In other words, there's not a lot of swearing. There's no swearing. You know, you speak generously about the people that you meet. She says, my women friends are all lined up, you know, wanting to read the book next. And so they all asked my mother, I said, what is it? Weren't you afraid to have your daughter go on this? And my mother looked at them and shook her head. She said, I've been her mother for 60 years. You know, I was a child who, on the playground that would be trying that, you know, what else could you do with a swing set? And so she said she learned very early just to look the other way. But I'm not a daredevil. I just have been an athlete. And so the idea of riding a motorcycle that weighs 800 pounds was not as frightening for me as somebody else. And that's why I keep saying my message and what I say to people is I would never say go ride a motorcycle. But I would say everybody I ever talk to when I say this is about blind curves, about answering what now, everybody has something in their life that they're going, oh, yeah, that part of my life. You know, I'm asking what now, and I'm afraid to move forward because nothing feels right. And I go, yep, I understand. We want clarity before we move forward. And the irony is clarity only comes once you start to try and fail and figure it out. So waiting for that moment of aha to come and say, this is the right thing, there are more and more times in life when that doesn't happen for us, where we just have to move forward. It's like being a parent. You know, those people who have had children, people can tell you what it's like to have a child. But when you have your own child, you find out that you have to learn as you go.
You know, it's interesting when you put it into that perspective to share with our listeners. It seems just recently, over the last few months, I began to read books from people from what are known as New Thought. And these are people that go back starting in the 1800s and move forward. Some people might recognize, like Napoleon Hill, for instance. I had a little allusion earlier to Florence Scovel Shen and a group of others, and these people wrote a lot about success and success principles. But back in the time when being politically correct wasn't as important as getting the message told, you know, just being straightforward about it. And consistently, as you read these writings, which I encourage a lot of people, go back and read some of this, because compared to what I've seen today when you read about success and success principles, to me, there tends to be, even though maybe the heart seems to be in the right place for the writers, a lot of stuff out there that's just a lot of parroting nonsense in some ways, but that's just me, my opinion.
What I was
going to point out is you hit something right on the head, and I was just recently reading this, is that we tend to, especially in today's world, have to be sure about circumstances before we take that first step. Like, there's this tremendous risk that's at such a level that when we make that choice, before we take that step, that we could lose our lives, for instance.
Right.
And so we become so blind in some ways that we miss the true golden opportunity, A, for the direct experience. And the second thing is the ability to grow and discover new things about ourselves that probably would astonish us if we would just try. And that's what I'm hearing clearly about what you're talking about here today.
Yes, and the other piece I would say is that, you know, life comes together and it falls apart. You know, and we think when we've been successful and finally gotten one part of our life together that it's going to stay that way.
Right.
And it's like a sweater. You can buy a brand new sweater and it looks beautiful, but at some point, you know, it's going to age and deteriorate. And it may be able that you can reinvent that sweater into something new again that's more beautiful again, or recycle it or reuse it. But we think that because we've gotten life together in one place, that that's going to remain permanent. And I think that's part of our society's problem, is we don't teach the fact that, yes, it comes together and it falls apart. Anybody who's been in a marriage knows that marriages, even successful ones, go through periods of time where you have to really spend some time and rebuild them again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything that we have, our relationships, even with a good friend, there are times when it's effortless and it's just perfect, and there's times when it's out of sync with each other. And I think we have to put together that mindset that when life starts falling apart or coming unraveled again, it's okay, that's normal. And we have come up with such an aversion to change, and we really don't teach that this is a normal process. It's like, oh my gosh, we see somebody else on TV or somebody else on stage, and look what they've gotten. But if we study every major business leader who was heralded as all sorts of brilliance, if you look at them 5 years later, their companies are often in disaster.
Right.
And the same man is leading it, or the same woman's leading it. And so Iacocca at one point was up, you know, held up and said, oh, my God, look what he's done for the motorcycle industry. And then when his company is going bankrupt, what happens? You know, Iacocca was supposed to be the brilliant leader, and he was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But things come together, things shift, things change.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just not regulated to say, that's a normal thing. It's not that you failed when those things change.
Mm-hmm.
And there are really opportunities to go back and look and make something stronger. I mean, a friendship or a marriage gets stronger once you face when it's not working and say, we got to really talk about this.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just such an interesting way that we have formulated ourselves into a belief system, for one, that really it can't work. It's just not possible, because life always finds a way to change whether you want to change with it or not. And that, I think that's the funny part about it, is when you can start to realize that, I think one of the most magnificent images that I could come up with is, for instance, the weeping willow or the flow of water. You know, if you can learn to be flexible and supple just like that, life will take you on a roller coaster ride that will just, you know, it'll amaze you. Or you can be like the oak, and you know what happens during a really rough storm? You start seeing branches break, you know, and then what? And it's fascinating, because as you took this trip, 2,500 miles is pretty astounding on a motorcycle, because you also realized that as you're there and you're really part, or you're in with what's going on, it's not like you're in a car and you're passively observing the scenery as it goes by you, but you're actively engaged in it, and you felt probably a heck of a lot tired by the end of the day driving or riding a motorcycle than you did driving, I'm sure.
Well, we definitely only tried to do, the most miles we did in one day was 350, but
mm-hmm.
most days we tried to do 200. Because you are so alert the whole time you're on
mm-hmm.
a motorcycle, and the wind is hitting you, and
mm-hmm.
the elements are hitting you, and so if it's cold or if it's hot, you know, you're not there with an air conditioner or a heater. And so we would take a break every 90 minutes, because you really can't stay on top of the driving. if the writing, if you go for long periods of time. So we would stop every 90 minutes and stop, get a cup of coffee or stop whatever. And to me, we always say about the motorcycle, it's the in the moment that it counts. And so you're not driving to get to a destination. The driving or the riding is the destination. So, by taking a break every 90 minutes and getting up and walking around and, sitting back and talking to local people, and it's not how much countryside you can see. It's also how many people you can talk to and interact with. So we would take 15-minute breaks every 90 minutes at least, if not more. But if you're, on the Oregon coast and you're passing all these beautiful dunes and whatnot, it's just you have time. Let's pull over. Mm-hmm. Let's stop. Let's go down on the beach. Let's enjoy it. And so play is a big part of motorcycling, and that was a very fun element.
Oh, absolutely. So I take it that a fair amount of your journey was Highway 101?
A lot of it was Highway 101, okay. But we kept cutting off of Highway 101
sure. And
going back roads. But the other thing I would say about a motorcycle journey is at the end of the day when we parked our motorcycles at the bed and breakfast or the hotel, we were often choosing some place that was out of the ordinary. We never rode our motorcycles to dinner if we could avoid it, because we like to have a glass of wine or a glass of beer at the end of the day. And we didn't want a motorcycle ride once we had any alcohol. So we would often be in a small town, and there would be only like one restaurant that would be a choice. And when you looked at the restaurant, you go, oh, my gosh. And one of the stories I have in Blind Curse is the night that we ended up going to this bar, and we walked in, and it was just like it was so smoky inside and it was so unwelcoming. But we just, you say, this is what you have to create from. And we got there and we added money to the jukebox, and we found out there was no hot food in the kitchen at all because it was the bar and she wasn't allowed to cook. And we ended up talking with her. I discovered they had clam chowder that was really great, and we got her to make her some salads and things. And we ended up playing pool, and we ended up having one of the best evenings of the trip from something that didn't provide us with a lot of choice. But the attitude of the group was, let's just make what we have work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of things, I think, what an adventure is all about is, okay, so if you're here and this is what you have, how do you make it work?
Mm-hmm. Best way, too, to sum it up for the listening audience out there also is to simply say, regardless of what happens, if it's something that seems undesirable at the moment, is simply ask yourself this question: what good will come of this?
Yes.
And you dynamically change the situation that's in front of you.
Well, yeah, if you look for the opportunities instead of the limitations. And I said, that people that grew up in a small town know what this is all about, because you can make a snowstorm turn into a pancake breakfast, or you can, a summer, hot summer day can turn into a sprinkling party with a picnic. People learned how to create their own amusement, and I guess that's part of a motorcycle ride is whatever presents itself, how do you make this be fun? And since you don't have a car where you can drive to 30 different restaurants, there's not a lot of discussion about how many restaurants you're going to go to. And when we're on motorcycles, we can't talk to each other. It's very loud. We could use hand signals with each other. So it really makes things a lot different when each of you is on a motorcycle and you can't really, speak to each other until you take your break. So there's lots of cooperation that goes on.
For those just joining us, we're talking with the motorcycle maven, Linda Krill, talking about her book, Blind Curves, as she decided to take a 2,500-mile journey in the Pacific Northwest on the back of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Now, Linda, with this trip, was there one moment that during this trip you felt something come in and just you knew something was different, it just transformed you? What was going on in that moment if, in fact, something like that happened?
Well, we agreed at the beginning of this trip that we would never go on any gravel roads because it's hard enough to balance a motorcycle.
Sure it is.
Mm-hmm. On regular highways, let alone a gravel road. And so everybody agreed, and that was an easy promise to make. But I always say that rules are made when we don't know the situations that we're going to have happen to us. And we got into a beautiful redwood forest, and we were really enjoying the tall redwood trees. And it was one of these parks, most people don't realize, but a lot of the parks in Northern California that are redwoods are in the areas where they could not immediately get to the trees and bring them into the sawmills and whatnot. So they're little tiny parks that are on sort of the outskirts, and there's what's left over that wasn't cut down. And so we are in one of these small state parks, and there's no park ranger when we come into the park. And funding has really deteriorated for a lot of these places. So we get in the park, and oh my gosh, the redwoods are every bit as special as everybody ever imagines them to be. And we saw that there was a 30-mile loop. And so we said, let's do the 30-mile loop, thinking we would spend the whole 30 miles in redwoods. Well, very quickly, when we started this loop, it turned into a one-way road, and the redwoods were gone. And so we get to about 35 miles, and we're all noticing this, and we're wondering what's happened. And meanwhile, this two-lane road has gone from two lanes, that's blacktop, down to one lane. And then it turns from blacktop into crumbling concrete, and we're going around blind curves and up over down hills and rises where you can't see what's on the other side. And this road now gets down to the size of a Volkswagen in width. And we're looking at each other, wondering what is going on, and it's 35 miles, and we should have completed the loop. And we suddenly, ahead of us, I notice the road disappears and goes into hard pack, you know, dirt. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, we said no to gravel, but this isn't gravel, this is dirt. And I'm watching the bikes in front of me, and they're going on them, okay, so I join it. And we finally, we're going now in first and second gear, and we're going very slowly, and suddenly in this big, huge meadow with grasses over our head, we come around the corner, and there is a gravel road in front of us, and it has switchbacks, four switchbacks that go up the side of this hill till it gets to the top. So you would have strong, steep curves. You would be going across it diagonally and have to do a strong curve four times to get to the top. It's covered with gravel, and it's been washed out. And we're looking at each other, and now we're stuck. We're stuck with two bad choices. Do we turn around and try to go backwards, you know, on this road that's one way, around all these blind curves and up over the top where if another car is coming towards us, we could easily wreck and get killed or kill them?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we try to go up this hill? And we've not seen a telephone pole. We've not seen one other car. We've not seen one other person. There's been no other choices. And not only that, if we get to the top of this hill, how do we know that the whole road's not going to just disappear to another, you know, 100 yards? So we're sitting there staring at this, and there were four of us at that point. And one of the guys just can't handle it anymore. And he takes off, and he does, and he makes it to the top. But he even on the top, the last curve, the fourth curve, because it's so tight, when you get up to the top of a hill because of the triangle, your turns are much quicker and much more steep than they are when you're at the bottom of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
So he even slides a little in that fourth one, but he gets up there. And now the other woman and I are looking at each other going, which are we going to do? Because we know whatever one of us does, the other will do. And I said that I flipped a coin into the air. I was trying to figure out the right decision. You know, here I am again trying to figure out what's best for everybody else, what's best for me. And my choices are two dangerous, bad choices. Because if we wreck, there's, you know, what's going to happen? We don't have doctors there. We don't have anybody that knows how to fix a motorcycle. You know, so we could be in worse shape. You know, so I said I tossed a coin in the air as to what I should do. And I just decided to go for it. And I immediately, around each of those curves, you know, you're leaning forward, trying to figure out how to do this. And you're just trying to stay so much in that moment and not let the voice of fear take over, because you can't listen to fear at that point. You have to be able to say, where's my gear? Where's the safest part of the road? What do I have to be doing now? Do I break down? Do I shift? And, of course, I didn't know how to do all this by being told by anybody else. You have to figure it out as you go. So you have to stay in the present moment the whole way. And on that last curve, I was sure my motorcycle was going to go down because I braked too late and it skidded, but I made it to the top. And I have to tell you that the elation I felt at that moment was greater than anything I had felt for the 18 months before my husband had died. And that's exactly the same kind of elation that came to me on the fourth day when I was taking my motorcycle license, and I finally passed it. Is what we don't realize is we think joy comes from eating fancy foods. We think joy comes from being with good friends. We think joy comes from taking vacations. But a lot of what really creates this tremendous joy is when we have stretched ourselves to the limit and we have succeeded.
Mm-hmm. And that's so true. And I don't think that we do that enough. You know, that I just remember there was a quote that says, if we could ever truly live to our fullest potential, we would simply astound ourselves.
And I think we are brought to those points in our life. And I think when people often think, oh, I could not be you. But if I get them to start thinking about themselves and about their history and their time with their children, everybody has some of these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying you should go stretch yourself to the limit in order to have it, but to think that joy doesn't come
Right.
So as I said before, when you can erase the boundary of fear, we keep forgetting the huge rewards that are there. And I think we have to be able to continuously find things in our lives that we struggle for, whether it's learning to speak a language and, you know, or to practice learning to speak a new language, and you finally are in a situation where you get to use it and it works. I mean, when you can speak, when I went to Mexico and spoke no Spanish, and when I started using a bunch of words and the Mexicans repeated back to me in Spanish, that was a moment of excitement. So I don't mean that all these things have to be huge types, but, you know, part of any learning, whether it's trying to learn how to send an email or be on Facebook and talk to your grandchildren, the first time you send a message to your grandchild and they return back a message, it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And Ken Blanchard, you know, author of the top seller, One Minute Manager, he says, we too often, we only want to celebrate the big wins, so we find ourselves disappointed more often. And he says, we just don't celebrate the little wins. And he says, that's where the miracles really are.
Yeah, and so I think he's exactly right. And I think all of us know those experiences. And mm-hmm. So to me, part of what, when I talk with groups, is helping them to remember these times in their own lives. In other words, it's not to look at Linda and say, oh, she's done this, or Daniel, he's done this, but it's to be reminded in our life, when were some of those very precious moments that we've had, or to start looking for them in our day and say, gee, you know, I've always said I was going to do X, you know, and I'm going to try that today, and just see, you know, what that is. But I always tell people, there's a lot of excitement when you start something new and you decided, okay, I'm going to learn to knit, I'm going to learn to crochet, I'm going to learn how to do photography. And then we get the camera or we get the knitting needles and we sit down and we immediately see, oh my God, this is much harder than I expected. And the enthusiasm wanes. And yet if you continue to get help and assistance or put it down and walk away and come back another day, I often say we have to chunk it down.
Mm-hmm.
So we do little pieces at a time and then come back and do a little bit the next day and next day. I had a ceiling fan that I needed to, I thought, gee, I can put that up myself. So I went to the Home Depot and I bought a ceiling fan and I came home and I opened it up and I found more parts inside of that ceiling fan. And I thought, who do you think? I was going to save myself the $150. I knew what I wanted to spend the $150 on, and it was not on somebody to put up my ceiling fan. And I just opened up all the parts and put them in, you know, put them on the floor, and I took a look and I walked away. And the next day I came back and I said, well, at least you can take a look at the instructions and start to take a look at what they call each part. So I did. And then I started getting very uptight, and I walked away. It took me 10 days to get that ceiling fan up. But by doing it one step at a time and one step at a time and one step at a time, I was amazed. I eventually got the ceiling fan up, and so far it's not fallen down. And so that idea of chunking it down, that bit of when fear starts to overcome you, take a break. You know, walk away. You know, come back again. I mean, there was no, if the ceiling fan, it was in a guest bedroom, so it was not something that I had to have done in one day. Of course, if I'd had 2 or 3 year olds running around or whatever else, I wouldn't have had that luxury.
Now, you know, Linda, you bring up a phenomenon that is very common with everyone, and you were bringing up the fact that you brought something new in to make an attempt at that you'd never done before. And you felt this fear well up into you. Now, believe it or not, that, and I'm sure you will believe it because it's a biological fact. What's going on there is the way the human brain works. And the funny thing about it is, and because we've done extensive talks here on the program about neurobiology
right.
and the way that the brain functions, and it was fascinating that if people could understand just this bit, they would realize that anything they decide to set out to do, that they're going to face this. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's something new, everyone will face this. And all you got to do is get over the hurdle with this one simple understanding, which once you know this, changes the whole game. It really does. The fact is the brain has to control every function of the human body to keep it running efficiently, to keep it healthy. I mean, it's in charge of your automatic breathing, when you go to sleep, when you wake up, the blood flowing, all of this, it's responsible for everything, the nervous system, just imagine. So it has this awesome responsibility to keep this beautiful human machine running to the top level that it can. Then on top of that, you know, you've got to be able to grow and to do new things. Now, to be able to do this, the brain has a lot of energy that it burns to do this. So like any good machine that's well made, it finds the most efficient way to do this to conserve energy, okay? So what it does is that's why you create habits, so that the brain can go on autopilot and simply do those things that you're used to doing. You face this fear of the new that you're about to take on because the brain is going, okay, wait a minute, okay, you're about to overload me with some extra energy. I've got to find those reserves from somewhere. Well, you know, basically, let's not do that. Let's just go ahead and keep things the way they were because I'm working at optimum efficiency here. Everything's been cool. You don't need to be doing this right now. See, that's where the thoughts come in.
Right.
And all you got to do is just push through that. And usually it doesn't take very long. In your case, it took 10 days with the ceiling fan. But you step through it, and then once the brain says, okay, it looks to me like you've made the commitment, okay, so let's go ahead and figure this out. And then a whole different phenomenon happens. It begins to solve the problem. And it wants to solve it as quickly as it can so it can go back to regulating and not using so much energy. Isn't that phenomenal to know that we all go through this?
Right. That's very interesting. And I think the other thing is we, when we resist something, are using a lot of energy.
Exactly.
And so I know that in anybody who's been a hiker or a walker or a runner knows what we call second and third breath.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what the body is doing is initially the heart is working so hard and whatnot, and it goes into what I call cruise control.
Mm-hmm.
As we do it, and we quit resisting it. And I said I was a bicycler, and I love bicycling, but I have learned that the first 15 minutes I'm on the bicycle and go out for a ride, I don't listen to my body complaining, because it always complains and always says, mm-hmm. oh, my gosh, you shouldn't do it today because of this reason or that, or my knees hurt, this hurts, that hurts. And but I know that if I continued biking, that 15 minutes later, all those messages are gone. There was this cute Snoopy cartoon in the papers 20 or 30 years ago that I have never forgotten from the Peanuts section. And Snoopy is jogging, and he has this little hat on his head to keep him warm, and it's in the middle of winter. And as he's running, the stomach grumbles and says, I'm hungry. And next phrase is the feet are complaining that they're too hot. And the next point, something else is complaining. And he keeps having bubbles come out of each part of his body with the complaint. And in the last frame, he said, whoever said that running is a solo effort has never run.
Mm-hmm.
And I laughed because there is that getting used to and adapting when you start something new.
Mm-hmm. And it's all fascinating, and you certainly learned that when you were reaching one of the most challenging moments that you felt at that time was the biggest one of your life.
Well, it's interesting what happens. I mean, the first mm-hmm. 3 or 4 days of the motorcycle journey, I said that I could have been in the middle of Kansas or the middle of South America, and I wouldn't have known the difference because I was so busy concentrating on riding the motorcycle and watching everything on the road, and every sound the bike was making was a new sound to me. I didn't have any of that automatic saying that this is just normal sound. So I was paying attention to everything, and my eyes were really watching the road and the road signs for, you know, anything that would be dangerous to me while I was riding, and I was noticing where the other people were around me, making sure I was keeping a safe distance. So I was hyper vigilant, and I didn't get to look at the scenery. I said I didn't even see what the rainforest looked like in the northwest part of Washington State because I was so busy watching the gray road in front of me between the yellow and white lines. But as the trip continued for the 10 days, by the time we got to day 5 and 6, I was really getting comfortable with my motorcycle. And by the end of the motorcycle journey, I said, you get to the place where the motorcycle and you become one instrument. It's no longer you're on top of a motorcycle and it's a separate piece from you. Mm-hmm. You don't even know when you're shifting the motorcycle or shifting your weight or whatever. I mean, you become one with the motorcycle. And that's a fun place to be. And I think people get that way in skiing. I think people get that way with boating. People get that way with bicycling. It's when you get to that place where you are so comfortable, and maybe riding a car can be the same way too. You don't actually think of yourself as being separate. You start to think of yourself as one instrument.
I know as you were sharing the story there about your Redwood adventure, I was reminded of the classic Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Yes.
And there's the part where he's talking about, you know, the funny thing about motorcycles is you'll start going on roads that typically you would probably never discover. And we call those, or as he would say, we tend to call those rudders. So first you're on a two-rudder road and everything seems kind of normal. and all of a sudden it reduces down to one rut of road, then pretty soon you find yourself on a dirt path, and before you know it, you're in someone's backyard or stuck in the middle of a cornfield.
Right.
As you were describing your story, it was just like rereading that book all over again.
You know, and I said it depends what your mindset is. I mean, you know, when you go on a motorcycle trip, I mean, the mindset is let's just get out and see a part of America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I forget, I'm sorry, I don't remember the person's name that said that you can actually, interstates have made it possible for us to go from one coast to the other coast of America without ever seeing anything.
Ah, there you go.
And so, you know, it is, as we all know, is when you get off the main highways and you are in the back roads of our country, you don't make great time, but mm-hmm. you do see so much more and learn so much more about the people. When you stop at rest stops along the turnpike and whatnot, you're not meeting the locals in the way that you would meet them when you go off onto the back roads.
Mm-hmm. Linda, what's next for you?
Well, I've written this book, and so I'm now learning all about how to do radio interviews like I'm doing with you, and TV appearances, and how to speak to groups about this. And the next couple of books I'm going to write are going to be more about reinvention. But right now, the book is on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's Books a Million. It comes in ebook format. It comes in softback format. So I've just been learning how to get a book published. And it's so much exciting, and things are happening. Libraries are starting to take it and put it in their libraries, and bookstores are starting to order it and put it in bookstores. So for me right now, this is where my excitement is learning what all this is about to be an author.
And then next, I believe it's probably going to be big wave surfing for you, right?
Well, I did, in writing this book, I did do a week on the trapeze course just to learn to learn how to write about fear. So, I mean, yes, I'm not going to bungee jump. That's awful. I mean, I do have a list of things I will not do.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I do want to be around to watch my children grow old.
Oh, very good. Well, Linda, is there a website people can find out more about?
Yes, there's two websites. If people remember the book's name is Blind Curves, there's blindcurves.com, and I am Linda Krill, and my last name is spelled C-R-I-L-L, and so lindakrill.com or blindcurves.com, and it will take you the same place.
And we'll be sure to post that on our blogspot at beyond50radio.blogspot.com, or just type in Beyond 50, and you'll see us right there at the top. Well, we want to thank you for joining us here on the Beyond 50 radio program today. Get some of those mothers to start saying to themselves, you know, it's about time to face that adventure that I once thought was just for everyone else.
I think that there's many people saying that, and I just say, you know, thumbs up, you know, enjoy the ride.
Thank you so much, Linda, for joining us here on the program today.
Thank you.
Remember, listeners out there, the book is Blind Curves. We're going to have a nice little post on our blog spot, as I said earlier, so you can find out more about that and find out where that next adventure takes you to. I'm Daniel Davis. Thank you for tuning in. This is the Beyond 50 radio program, and remember, live your day past halfway.